loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, this is the third and final day of the BRICS meeting. That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and this time joined by Turkey. As the United States, the EU, and other Western powers are fracturing and fighting, and a trade war is underway, will BRICS become a bigger global power? And then we take a look, as we do every Friday, it's our political segment. We take a look at the political races around the country in the run-up to the midterm elections in November.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, today marks the 65th anniversary of the Armistice Agreement in the Korean War, but the peninsula technically remains in a state of war to this day. To mark the occasion and push forward toward a permanent peace treaty, North Korea today repatriated the remains of 55 U.S. servicemen killed during the war, the result of a promise North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made to President Trump when they met in Singapore last month. More than 7,000 Americans are still listed as missing in action in North Korea. Next, President Trump called today's news that gross domestic product had grown at a very robust 4.1% for the second quarter of 2018 amazing. He didn't comment, however, on the fact that much of the growth was due to consumers making major purchases before the effect of tariffs begins. He also promised that GDP, quote, would go a lot higher than this, unquote. Then, the online news site The Daily Beast reported unequivocally today that, quote, the Russian intelligence agency behind the 2016 election cyber attacks targeted Senator Claire McCaskill as she began her 2018 re-election campaign, unquote. The Daily Beast cites as proof its own forensic analysis and specifically blames the GRU, Russia's military intelligence service. The story already has been repeated as fact by National Public Radio. And then Donald Trump thought he had a deal with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to release a U.S. pastor being held in Turkey on trumped-up espionage charges in exchange for Israel releasing a Turkish woman being held on espionage charges there. But that deal fell through, leading to angry and threatening tweets between the two leaders. The result has been a quick and significant downturn in U.S.-Turkish relations. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll take a look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. And in other headlines, the government's court-mandated deadline to reunify the more than 2,500 children who had been separated from their parents at the border was yesterday. And as of yesterday, the government had reunified 1,442 children with their parents, far short of the court's demands. Another 700 children were called ineligible for reunification, including 430 whose parents have already been deported. Of those 1,442 children who have been given back to their parents, 900 of those families are now facing deportation. A delegation from the Syrian Democratic Council, the political arm of the Kurdish YPG-led Syrian Democratic Forces, is in Damascus for talks with the government. The delegation was invited by the government to discuss the future of the country and a possible peace treaty to put an end to the civil war. The SDF has been the principal ally of the United States in Syria, and a rapprochement with the government would mark a major shift in the conflict. Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman announced that 400 new homes for settlers will be constructed in the occupied West Bank. Lieberman claimed that the new construction was retaliation for a stabbing attack carried out by a 17-year-old Palestinian. Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos is planning to eliminate more rules put into place during the Obama administration, according to a draft regulation leaked to the New York Times. These regulations required that graduates from for-profit colleges find jobs that pay enough to pay off federal loans, otherwise the government would stop administering loans to those colleges. This is one of a series of Obama-era for-profit school regulations that DeVos has begun to derail. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the summit of the BRICS countries, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They are completing their 10th summit today in Johannesburg, South Africa. All of the countries are represented by their heads of state, and they met to discuss international peace and security, global governance and trade, and of course, relations among them. We're joined from North Carolina by Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn is a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many, many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. Dr. Horn, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Horn, from your point of view, if you were to rank this BRICS summit as in its significance, both for the BRICS countries and for Africa, where do you place it?
Well, the easiest answer is that for Africa itself, it's probably the most important meeting on the African continent since 1958, when Ghana's Kwame Nkrumah organized the equivalent of a Pan-African Congress featuring emerging national liberation movements, many of which were to seize power in the next 2 to 5 years. It's not only because these giants of the global economy, including China and India, are present in Johannesburg, it's also that they've been joined by a slew of African countries. They have been joined by Argentina just across the Atlantic Ocean. In many ways, this BRICS summit helps to illustrate and underscore why the group of 20, the G20, is supplanting the G7 led by the United States. The group of 20, of course, includes the BRICS countries plus countries like Argentina. Then you have the presence of countries like Jamaica, representing the Caribbean community, and also, of course, the Caribbean community, including nations like Barbados, Trinidad and Tobago, Haiti, etc. And it's also the fact that in the run-up to this important summit, you had, for example, Prime Minister Modi of India touring Africa, just like President Xi Jinping of China toured Africa. In Uganda, Prime Minister Modi not only made an announcement that India would be opening 18 new embassies on the African continent in coming months, which could be a game changer for the continent in light of the fact that India, within coming decades, might be surpassing China in terms of grabbing the crown as the leading economy on planet Earth, and certainly will be the most populous nation on planet Earth. Also important was that there was an implicit apology to India, because recall that some decades ago, under leader Idi Amin, Uganda expelled nationals of South Asian origin, replicated in the Hollywood movie starring Denzel Washington, speaking of Mississippi Masala, and that helped to salve old wounds as well. I should also say that the BRICS summit, most importantly, by its own declaration, involves a merger of the BRICS agenda with the African and Caribbean development agenda. Therefore, you should expect to see the BRICS Bank, which is a challenger to the World Bank headquartered in Washington, D.C., spend more on infrastructure in Africa and the Caribbean. I'm thinking, for example, of the Nairobi to Mombasa railway built by Chinese interests, which has been a shot of pure adrenaline to the economy of Kenya. I'm speaking of the North-South Highway built by Chinese interests in Jamaica, which has opened up all sorts of economic opportunities for that small Caribbean island. So it's difficult to overestimate the significance and profundity of this meeting that's unfolding as we speak in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Dr. Horn, I wanted to ask if there was anything more than economics at play here. Is this an attempt or an effort, maybe is a better word to use, an effort by African leaders to sort of take a place in foreign affairs or international affairs outside of the United Nations by making themselves a more powerful bloc?
Well, it's not only that, but it's also a rebuff and rebuke to Washington and Donald J. Trump specifically. There have been explicit and implicit condemnations of this new trade war that Mr. Trump has initiated. And, of course, China is firing back not only from the summit in Johannesburg with the remarks of President Xi Jinping, but China has just scuttled an attempt by Qualcomm, a chips manufacturer headquartered in Southern California, to gobble up NXP, a Dutch manufacturer of the same product. It had to be signed off by 9 different countries, including China. 8 did. China said no. And that means that Qualcomm will be basically rebuked by its shareholders as a result of this rebuff by China. Keep in mind as well that there are a number of U.S. corporations that earn a pretty penny in China. I'm speaking of Apple and Microsoft and KFC, for example. And I dare say that they will have to take a haircut, to use Wall Street parlance, because of this trade war. And so it's no accident, it seems to me, that as the BRICS summit was unfolding and being launched on Wednesday, July 25th, President Trump was meeting in the Oval Office with Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission, the executive arm of the European Union, and in some ways retreating on his declaration that the EU was a, quote, foe, unquote. He basically hailed this idea that somehow the EU would replace China as a buyer of soybeans. Of course, the farm belt in the United States is suffering because of that fact that Mr. Trump has launched a trade war against China, and China is retaliating by not buying as many soybeans from Western farmers. I should also say that those economic numbers that Mr. Trump touted in a press conference this morning at the White House, those numbers are undergirded by the reality that in May, China recognized that there would be this trade war being launched. And so they gobbled up many soybeans and other products. So let's look at what the numbers are coming in the next quarter as a result. I'm saying all this to say that the BRICS summit represents a new bloc. That is to say, a bloc led by Russia and China and India and Brazil and South Africa that will be challenging increasingly the hegemony, not only of the United States, but also of the European Union. And I think that when Mr. Trump met with Mr. Juncker, it was a recognition of the fact that Mr. Trump may be revising his geopolitical strategy. Advised by Henry Kissinger, he had embarked on this path of seeking to neutralize Russia, hence the Helsinki summit. But because of the negative reaction and because of the fact that China has proved to be more muscular than anticipated with regard to combating the trade war, now Mr. Trump may be adopting the Democratic Party strategy of Hillary Clinton, which is uniting with the EU against Russia and China. I might say that for our constituencies, both strategies are harebrained and doomed to defeat.
That's the voice of Dr. Gerald Horn. We're talking to him about the conclusion of the BRICS summit in Johannesburg, South Africa. The BRICS countries, of course, represent Brazil, Russia, India, China, and now South Africa. You know, I just want to step back, if we can, Dr. Horn. I was thinking about this morning when I got up. It's the 65th anniversary of the armistice that ended the Korean War today. At that time, there were two blocks in the world. There was the U.S.-led bloc of the former colonial powers, including its defeated enemies, Japan and Germany, as well as its allies, Britain and France and others. And then on the other side, there was the Soviet Union. There was China, North Vietnam, North Korea, the Eastern and Central European Socialist Bloc nations. There were two competing global powers. That ended at the end of, you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, certainly, in 1991, and with the Eastern and Central European powers a few years before that. But even before that implosion, there was the breakup of that bloc, and principally the division between Russia and China, the two major powers that provided the sort of the anchor for this counter-hegemonic phenomena in global politics following the World War II. Now these countries are not really ideological. I mean, certainly China is still led by the Communist Party. Russia is not led by a Communist Party. But there's not the sense of ideological camaraderie at all. And yet, nonetheless, we see the reemergence based on national interests of those who seek and must seek, actually, to find a way to counterbalance U.S.-led, you know, former colonial constructs that have dominated the world for the last couple hundred years. Anyway, I want to get your take on some of that.
Well, I think you hit the nail right on the head. And to update that pivotal moment some 45-odd years ago, when U.S. President Richard M. Nixon arrived in China and worked out an entente with the Chinese leadership, including Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, on an anti-Soviet basis, which led to a kind of encirclement of the then Soviet Union and led, in my opinion, inexorably to its collapse by 1991. It seems that Henry Kissinger, in particular, who's doddering around now in his mid-90s, if you read very carefully the interview he did with Edward Luce in the Financial Times of London just this past weekend, it's difficult to not walk away with the conclusion that Mr. Kissinger is trying to work his old magic. Recall that he was a prime architect between the Nixon-Mao summit. Now he's counseling that Washington should cozy up to Moscow in order to at least cast shadows on the Moscow-Beijing entente, which is underscored by mega deals, including Gazprom, the Russian company, sending natural gas to China. Now, Mr. Kissinger not only feels that there should be a disruption of the Russia-China entente, but there should also be an attempt to stir up resentments between India and China. Keep in mind that preceding the summit between Mao and Nixon was the 1962 conflict war between India and China, with, I'm afraid to say, India coming off second best. Now you see that U.S. imperialism has renamed its so-called Pacific Command the Indo-Pacific Command, tending to signify that India possibly could be enlisted to an encirclement policy of China. Keep in mind as well that beating a path to the doorstep of the prime minister in New Delhi in recent years has not only been Barack Obama, but also Bill Clinton before him, not to mention corporations that are heavily invested in China that are now investing in India. I'm speaking of Amazon in the first instance. Keep in mind as well that part of the conflict behind the scenes in Johannesburg at the BRICS summit as we speak is that India is reportedly reluctant to have a kind of BRICS plus arrangement where more nations are admitted to BRICS because it fears and suspects that they'll be more pro-Beijing than pro-New Delhi. You may also know that China has been reluctant to expand the membership of the United Nations Security Council, which includes the EU nations such as Britain, France, the United States, Russia, and China. It does not want to include India, which is on the road to being the most populous nation on planet Earth, which I think is a mistake on China's part, but I understand the motivation. And certainly, I think that those interested in international peace and security should not only watch and monitor very carefully this evolving India-China relationship, because it may be the key and the guarantor of international peace and security, but also it may be the key and guarantor to ensuring that the promises and pledges of the BRICS summit unfolding in Johannesburg that bids fair to be such a boon to Africa and the Caribbean will actually be upheld, speaking of those promises.
That's Dr. Gerald Horn. We're speaking to Dr. Horn from North Carolina. Normally, we speak to him from Houston, where he is a professor at the University of Houston and the author of many, many books. Dr. Gerald Horn is H-O-R-N-E for the last name and E at the end. If people want to go online and look for Dr. Horn's books, there's so many of them. They're amazing. We really want to encourage our readers. I know, including friends of mine and people who are around the country who are doing political organizing, who are using Dr. Horn's books in many of the sort of proliferating study groups that are going on right now in America as there's a renewed interest in progressive social change. We're talking about the BRICS summit. Dr. Horn, what about Brazil? You know, at the beginning when BRICS was formed, it was Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa came later. But Brazil was under the leadership of Lula, under the leadership of a left of center workers' party. Now we have there at the summit, Michel Temer representing really the neoliberal elites in Brazil who by fiat of judicial legislative coup d'etat, ousted Dilma Rousseff and now have imprisoned Lula. How does the internal politics of Brazil impact Brazil's standing in an organization like BRICS?
Well, like many in Johannesburg today, I'm very worried and concerned about Brazil. It's not only the current presence of Mr. Temer, who could very well be seen as an illegitimate leader because of that coup, as you noted, pulled off against Dilma Rousseff, his predecessor, and then the current jailing of Lula da Silva, a previous Brazilian president, who by many accounts is still ahead of the polls in terms of this upcoming election in Brazil. Obviously, this casts doubt and shadows on the legitimacy of the Brazilian delegation in Johannesburg. But perhaps even more worrisome than that is the fact that if Mr. da Silva is not allowed to run for the presidency, there is some reporting that suggests that the next president of Brazil might be this character, Bolsonaro, who, as Steve Bannon, the former Trump advisor, might say, was Trump before Trump was Trump. That is to say, he is a neo-fascist. He has support from the Brazilian military, which, as you know, has intervened repeatedly in the internal domestic and civilian affairs of Brazil, up to and including a coup d'etat some years ago that was quite bloody and brutal that led to the torturing of a young Dilma Rousseff. And that I find quite worrisome. Certainly, it goes against one trend in Latin America. For example, the recent election of President AMLO, López Obrador, in Mexico, taking office on December 1st, a turn to the left. It is obviously contrary to the solidifying of the regime in Havana with the promulgation of a new constitution and the continued leadership in Bolivia of Evo Morales and the continued leadership in Venezuela, President Maduro. But on the other hand, of course, we've seen a turn to the right in Argentina. And certainly, if Bolsonaro emerges triumphant in this election a few months from now, it'll not only be a setback for Brazil, it'll be a setback for the BRICS, because how can the BRICS leaders be confident meeting in a summit with Brazilian leaders who they know are quite close to Washington, who could be seen fairly as a cat's paw of Washington? It would be quite disruptive to the BRICS, and let us hope that Mr. Bolsonaro does not emerge triumphant.
Very, very interesting. Dr. Horn, let's talk about how the Chinese government in particular invests in Africa. We started this interview with you talking about the trip that Xi Jinping, as well as the Indian leader went throughout Africa or to different countries in Africa. But I want to talk about the difference, because I think there's a lot of confusion about this, and how China is doing long-term investment and development projects in Africa, say, in contrast to those coming from West Europe or from the United States. Could you talk about that?
Well, I mean, look no further than Zimbabwe, right across the border from South Africa, where you're having an election within the next 48 to 72 hours that may lead to the dislodging of the ZANU-PF regime, which has ruled since independence in 1980, or may lead to the continuation. Recall that Zimbabwe was a British colony, and then after South African elections in 1994, the regime embarked on land reform, seizing land from the European minority that had gained that land through means mostly foul, that led to sanctions on the regime, which drove the economy into the ditch and led to world-class inflation. And of course, what the regime tried to do in Harare was then look east, because China had been a major supporter of the National Liberation Movement before independence in 1980. And that has led to significant state investment, if you like, in Zimbabwe. But I think that a major difference between what's happening with regard to Chinese policy in Africa and, say, U.S. policy, for example, is that if you look at the projects that I've mentioned, for example, the Nairobi to Mombasa Railway, or the railway recently built in Ethiopia, a discussion of a Cape to Cairo railway, which has been a dream of Pan-Africanists for more than a century, you see that irrespective of what one might say about the intentions of Chinese leaders, at the end of the day, they're leaving infrastructure behind that can be used for generations to come. I would urge your listeners to walk very carefully in terms of absorbing the propaganda about Chinese policy in Africa. I just heard a report on BBC this morning, for example, British Broadcasting, which was castigating a Chinese policy, suggesting that it was luring African nations into a debt trap. That is to say, they posited this notion about Sri Lanka, how Chinese interests built a port there, and they said that Sri Lankans fell behind on the payments, and then that led to Chinese supposedly seizing the port. The Sri Lankan authorities have questioned the veracity of those reports, which originally appeared in the New York Times, you may recall. But I think that the larger and wider picture is that we're in the midst of this transformation. We're seeing the eclipse of the so-called American century, and we're seeing the birth of a new world order, but not the one that George H.W. Bush envisioned when he helped to coin that phrase some 25 odd years ago. And this is going to be a profound development. It will shake the North Atlantic order, and therefore it will lead to a tidal wave of incessant propaganda, some of which we're seeing right now with regard to seeking to defame the Chinese role in Africa.
Dr. Horn, in just the last couple of minutes that we have, I wanted to ask you if there was any downside to this Chinese investment. You know, the Chinese are active not just in Africa, but really all over the world, and they're looking to make major infrastructure investments. In Greece, as soon as the economy collapsed, it was the Chinese who went to the government and offered to buy the ports of Piraeus and Chania and Crete and really saved those ports. The last time I was in Yemen, people were talking about the money that the Chinese had spent to build highways around the country where none had existed before. We know that they're doing the same thing in places like Ethiopia and Djibouti and Eritrea. But is there any real downside when a country is so underdeveloped that anything the Chinese do actually helps the economy?
There is a possible downside, but I'm afraid to say that we're in a world right now that has two major blocks. One represented in Johannesburg, and the other represented in the Oval Office on Wednesday with the European Union and the United States. As between those two choices, if I'm in power, in Africa in particular, I know what block I'm opting for. Keep in mind as well that Chinese interests are also very heavily involved in the United States of America as well, particularly in terms of real estate. In fact, one of the reasons why the real estate market in Seattle is cooling off is because of the trade war and Beijing discouraging Chinese investment in Seattle real estate, for example. Something similar is happening in Southern California. So I think it's fair to suggest that 45 odd years ago, Kissinger and Nixon helped to create what they would now consider to be a Frankenstein monster. And it's not up to me to reprimand or rebuke the kind of handiwork that has now resulted. That is to say, to try to castigate or criticize the Chinese role when we're still in this death match with U.S. imperialism and EU imperialism.
That's the voice of Dr. Gerald Horn. I'm just looking, John, at the Wall Street Journal. It's just exactly what Dr. Horn is saying. The headline is, "When the world opened the gates of China," it's a picture of Bill Gates talking to the Chinese prime minister at the time. And the question that the headline asks is, was it a mistake for the U.S. to allow China to join the World Trade Organization? An assessment of the 2001 decision. Now, of course, you see the dominant position within the Trump administration is to defeat China, to stop China. And of course, Barack Obama's pivot towards Asia was exactly with the same motivation. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from North Carolina by Dr. Gerald Horn, professor of history at the University of Houston, the author of many, many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. It's Friday, and that means it's time to take a look at political races around the country in the run-up to midterm elections in November. We're joined here in the studio by Jacqueline Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Jackie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
We've got a lot to talk about. You emailed me several ideas that, frankly, I had missed. I'm so focused on polls and on individual races that sometimes I don't see the forest for the trees. But you sent me a couple of really important ones. Let's start by talking about Georgia. What can you tell us about what's happening in Georgia? And let me give a little bit of a spoiler.
Please do.
The spoiler is most people are not focused on the notion that Georgia is legitimately turning purple. And it all depends on turnout.
Yes.
So go ahead.
So Georgia has been one of those sleeper races that I've been sort of paying attention to, but now I'm really focused on because I really do believe it is like the bellwether for where this country is going to go politically. Because Stacey Abrams, African-American woman, has faced a lot of criticism that is just really silly, but I think it's kind of indicative of where we are politically. You know, people are making a big deal about the fact that she's $200,000 in debt from student loans. Right. But for me, as an African-American who's, you know, middle-aged, I remember that push that a lot of black parents gave their kids.
Sure.
That, you know, you get a college degree, you get a better job. And that was fine for a while. But now that the economy has shifted so drastically, now getting a college degree saddles you with an enormous amount of debt.
Sure.
And that's especially more true for black college students. So Stacey Abrams is not only typical of your average American college graduate, she's particularly emblematic of your typical black college graduate.
That Stacey Abrams is $200,000 in student debt tells me far, far more about the country and the Department of Education and the situation with student loans than it tells me about Stacey Abrams, other than it tells me that Stacey Abrams worked really, really,
really hard,
to get an education.
A stellar education.
And it's paying off, and the Republicans are worried about it.
Right. And they should be doubly worried because of who has just won the Republican primary.
Go ahead. Explain that, because I was going to say the same thing.
I mean, where you have what should be the stereotypical American success story with all kinds of caveats and warnings about the true dire nature of the American economy, that somebody is successful with 200 grand in student debt alone. That's not a mortgage. But on the other end of the spectrum, you have this guy, Brian Kemp, who just won the GOP primary. He was endorsed by Donald Trump, enthusiastically endorsed by Donald Trump. And the thing that's notable about Kemp is that he is unapologetically pandering to the white grievance identity politics fears that a lot of people who swear all up and down they are not white supremacists,
right,
but they subscribe to all of the fear tactics that Trump used to win the election, that the immigrants are coming in and they're making America brown and the black people are lazy and they're taking your benefits and the Democrats are all liberals and they want to all abort your babies and all that kind of stuff. It's ridiculous that these are the things. And I'm not even exaggerating. His campaign ad showed him saying things like, oh, I'm going to reach across the aisle. And then there's a little explosion in the background with him, and then him responding, yeah, right, I'm not going to do that.
Oh, good heavens.
He's in a pickup truck and revving the pickup truck and intoning his support for zero tolerance immigration policies. He's saying that he's for the Second Amendment and he's racking a shotgun in the I mean,
so what you're saying is there's a very clear choice to be made here.
Very clear choice to be made in Georgia. The interesting backstory. Now, that's all the surface stuff that's really juicy and sexy and gets all of the attention. Here's the backstory. Brian Kemp was the head of the election commission or something or other like that in Georgia. For years, Stacey Abrams has been working to boost the Democratic Party by expanding the voter base.
Mm-hmm. Registering voters.
Yes.
Yep.
Kemp has been her longtime adversary.
Yes. In fact, he's the guy that's been responsible for purging the voter rolls
yes.
of legitimate voters.
Exactly. So this long-standing battle between we're not just talking about Brian Kemp, you know, the obvious, just deplorable, and I do mean that pun completely intended, deplorable politician and person, and you know, versus Stacey Abrams, by any other measure, in any other universe, highly qualified, very accomplished politician, whether she's black, whether she's a woman or not. We're talking about a longstanding battle of ideologies that is playing out in Georgia.
I think you're exactly right. Let's talk about another politician who wants to run his mouth and just gets himself in trouble every time he does. There's a minor congressman, a backbenching congressman, mm-hmm. a Republican from northwestern Minnesota by the name of Jason Lewis. And he made a statement this week that made me laugh out loud mm-hmm. and then made me ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
And what he said was that he misses the old days when you could call a woman a slut. What voting block was he trying to attract with that stupid statement?
As stupid and as repulsive as that statement is, let me tell you, the people who respond to that kind of rhetoric are absolutely white, evangelical, Christian, fundamentalist. They exist.
But this is the problem, because those people are going to vote for him anyway.
Yes.
So an outrageous statement like this is not going to attract independents, and it's not going to convince Democrats to cross over and vote Republican in this race. This is one of those self-inflicted wounds that the Republicans often make every 2 years. We saw it 4 years ago, 6 years ago, I guess it was, in Indiana. We saw it 6 years ago in Missouri. I mean, we saw it in Delaware in that Senate race, and in the Senate race in Nevada as well 6 years ago. They get these otherwise strong candidates in a year that candidate can actually win.
Right.
And then they just blow it.
Yeah. I mean, because here is the truth. And I think I can say this with a little bit of authority, because I am a Christian and I've been around some of these people. I've left churches because of their just horrendous political ideology. When we hear these kinds of statements from male candidates, the mistake we on the left make is that we believe that women are not supportive of this ideology. And like I said last week, yes, they are.
Yes,
in
they
these
are.
Circles, yes, they are.
Sure, they
do
are.
Believe.
People forget about Phyllis Schlafly?
Yes, they do believe that male leadership is God appointed, and that women are supposed to carry themselves in a certain way, and that's their role. But they also believe that their message resonates with people who have quote unquote values. And they believe that these are valid values that any real American should have.
I watched a speech that one of these guys made not too long ago, and he was utterly unapologetic about his extremist views. And when asked, but how do you expect to win the race? He said, it's all about turnout. We don't want them to turn out. We have to work hard to make it so that they don't turn out, or they can't turn out. He said, that's how we win the race.
Exactly. There's that. And then there is this hope that some of them have, that they are speaking to people who have not felt comfortable expressing these kinds
You're right.
of beliefs, because they don't want to be attacked.
And that's why polls are unreliable.
Exactly. So it's a two-pronged kind of perspective that we have to be careful. We don't dismiss either one of these
You're right.
weird kind of ideologies.
Because it's potentially very dangerous.
It is.
Very dangerous for the country. I want to keep on this line here of saying mm-hmm. stupid things. Here's another one that actually made me laugh out loud this week when I saw it on the news. This was in Florida. Representative Don DeSantis, who's actually not so bad of a guy, you know,
yeah.
But he made this outrageous statement about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who we've spoken about a number of times on this show. He said, and I quote, "That girl Ocasio-Cortez, or whatever she is, and then continued on with his sentence. What was that supposed to mean?
Again.
And he refused to apologize. He refused to retract it.
Again, when you have that little innate respect for a person, that kind of stuff comes out of your mouth. That's not as he tried to brush it off. I don't have a problem with her. I have a problem with her socialist policies. Right. First of all, her policies are hardly socialist.
Hardly.
Hardly socialist. They're just what the Democratic platform should have been.
That's right.
Should be. That's all her policies are. So, but when you have that much disrespect for people in general, that kind of stuff just comes out of your mouth because it's in there. That's why he's not apologizing, because he really has no respect for Ocasio-Cortez as a woman, as a human being, as a person, and certainly not as a politician.
And he knows that he can get away with it because his constituents feel the same way.
Exactly, because all he had to do was call her a socialist, and that's like a shocking thing his constituents.
That's right. I want to turn to a piece in Politico that was published this week that has to be exciting news for Democrats. This is a series of polls done by Marquette University. Marquette is very, very good in their polling operations. They're usually right on the money. And they found several different things, the most striking of which is that Governor Scott Walker, who has won two terms already and is running for a third term, is now trailing his leading Democratic challenger, by double digits. Now, there are a whole bunch of Democrats running for governor in Wisconsin. It was 12. Four of them have dropped out. It's down to 8. But there are two that are particularly strong. The strongest is a guy named Tony Evers, who's the state education superintendent. Nobody really knows this guy, but he's done a good job in the education system in the state of Wisconsin. He's running for governor. And the latest poll shows him beating Governor Walker 54-41. Now, 50, of course, is the magic number.
Right.
But how striking is it that a two-term incumbent governor can only muster 41%?
When you have championed a disastrous policy like right to work, and the teachers in your state have risen up in repudiation of those policies, then this is what happens. This is the kind of turnaround in your political career that happens when you support policies that you claim are designed to empower workers, but then the workers find out, wait a minute, you hoodwinked us, you pulled the wool over our eyes, and this right to work policy is nothing more than the evisceration of unions.
We call it the right to work for less.
That's right.
Another interesting thing is the trend, because a poll was taken. Marquette took a poll in June, and June was what, the other day,
right?
June just happened, and it showed Governor Walker winning by 4 percentage points, 48-44 over Evers. Well, this is a major turnaround, and what they're saying in this piece is that there is a trend in that there have already been down ballot races in Wisconsin this year, and the Democrats swept them.
They did. That's true.
So we're talking state legislatures. We're talking about the office of Secretary of State, the office of Lieutenant Governor.
Right.
We're talking about major, important state political offices. It looks like there's going to be a wave in the state of Wisconsin, and Scott Walker's on his way out.
We can hope. Let's let's hope that wave maintains its strength.
Well, one of the interesting things, too, in this Politico article is that they go on to talk about other neighboring states, and they quote an NBC Marist poll. And again, Marist is also very reliable. So NBC and Marist say that in Michigan, Democrat Gretchen Whitmer, who's the front runner in her party's primary for governor, is leading the Republican front runner, Bill Schuette, 47-38.
Yeah.
47-38. So nobody's at 50 yet, but 47 is a lot closer to 50 than 38 is. Another one is in Minnesota, where former Republican Governor Tim Pawlenty, he was also a conservative congressman for many years and is highly respected on both sides of the aisle. He actually dropped out of the Republican Party for about a decade and was an independent and ran for president, 8 years ago as a Republican. He lasted about 20 minutes.
Yep.
So he's running for governor in Minnesota. He's well known, and he trails both of the top Democratic candidates, Lori Swanson and Tim Walz, the polls show both Swanson and Walz beating him 51-40.
Yeah. I mean, I think that just speaks to the change in leadership that people want. People are kind of tired of the old guard, no matter how well-respected and well-known and well-liked some of these people are. They're really tired of the old guard. I think we're seeing that more with the Republicans in the state primaries and the midterms. Yep. But I think that's also happening with the Democrats. I think it's more damaging for the Republicans.
It's one of those years. And I'm going to get to that in a few minutes. But it's one of those years that people are talking about really throwing the bums out.
Yes.
And we're seeing it not just concentrated in one part of the country, but all over the place. If we're talking about Beto O'Rourke within striking distance of Ted Cruz in Texas, for heaven's sake, or we're talking about an African-American woman winning the governor's race in Georgia.
Right.
We're talking about a watershed event.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, there are a couple of other polls in the same region. In Wisconsin, again, for that Senate race, we talked about the Senate race 2 weeks ago, where we said if there's going to be a surprise Democratic upset somewhere, it's going to be Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Well, this latest poll has Tammy Baldwin beating her two Republican challengers, one by 15 percentage points and the other by 17 percentage points. So it looks like that's not going to happen. In the Michigan Senate race, Debbie Stabenow, who's been three terms now?
Yeah.
18 mm-hmm. years. Very popular. And she's beating her two potential Republican challengers also by 15 percentage points and 18 percentage points. And in the Minnesota Senate race, you remember Al Franken had to resign in shame and was replaced by Tina Smith. Tina Smith said when she took the job that she didn't want it.
That's true.
She was taking the job temporarily just to be sort of a transition senator until there could be another election. Well, she decided she's going to run for re-election, and she is just crushing the Republican nominee Karen Housley 49-35.
That's not a bad job. That's not bad for a job you didn't want.
I'll say that's pretty doggone good if you ask me.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you also about, and I never want to talk about this again after we finish this segment.
Uh-oh.
I want to talk about West Virginia and Don Blankenship.
Oh my gosh. Why won't he go away?
Well, I think he is. I think this is the end of it. Now, our listeners will remember that Don Blankenship is the guy who, he's a billionaire coal mine owner. He didn't pay any attention to safety regulations or safety laws. 29 miners were killed in a cave-in and explosion at one of his mines. He went to prison for it and came out and ran for the Senate. He got whipped in the Republican primary and then announced immediately that he would run as the candidate of the Constitution Party, which is an extreme right-wing party. But West Virginia has a law called the Sore Loser's Law, and it says that if you have lost the primary of one of the two major parties, you are prohibited by law from taking the nomination of a third party or running as an independent. So he announced that he's going to run as a constitutional party nominee. No, he's not.
No, he's not. And no. I don't understand how you can claim to run as the nominee for the Constitution Party, but
joke.
You don't know the laws of your own, the election laws of your own state. That's kind of ridiculous. So the Secretary of State for West Virginia, we hope, put the final nail in the coffin of the Don Blankenship funeral march.
It sure seems that way. Although, who knows? Don Blankenship also owns homes in Utah and Colorado, and he may go out there and make trouble.
I mean, I guess he couldn't do any worse.
No, I suppose not. Moving up to the presidential situation, Christine Todd Whitman is a former moderate Republican governor of New Jersey. She went on to be George W. Bush's EPA director. Highly respected, both sides of the aisle, highly educated. She was an excellent governor, easily won re-election in a Democratic state. She became the first Republican governor, current or former, to call on Donald Trump to resign. Yeah, to actually resign. Oh. This was carried in the Hill newspaper, but she did it in a Los Angeles Times op-ed. So it's not like she whispered this at a cocktail party.
Right.
She went public and she said, and I quote here, "My Republican colleagues have to end their willful ignorance of the damage Trump is doing, both domestically and internationally. We must put aside the GOP label, as hard as that may be, and demonstrate the leadership our country needs by calling on this president to step down."
That's like a small scale nuclear explosion.
Seriously.
In the GOP landscape right now.
And it has to be seen as a crack in the wall. And once that crack forms, you know, sometimes water starts slipping through. And when you have the likes of Jeff Flake, the junior senator from Arizona, saying everything anti-Trump that comes to his mind, except Trump should resign, you know, and Bob Corker whispering behind closed doors that Trump should resign.
Right.
I think this is going to prove to be a problem for the Republicans over the next 2 years.
I really do think it is also, especially since you have the moral leadership of Christine Todd Whitman penning this op-ed very public. But you also have these smaller cracks that are happening at the state level in the local, in the down ballot races, like in Oregon. Now she's a former Republican, Lori Stigman, who switched to the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. And at the state level, in the legislatures, this is happening more and more.
Yes.
Now, we saw Democrats switching to the Republican Party mm-hmm. all through the Obama years.
Yeah.
Even Senator John Kennedy, now a Republican from Louisiana, had been the Democratic Attorney General of Louisiana
right.
before switching parties. So now we're seeing the reverse of that.
Right. And it is... It's a problem. It's going to have to be a problem. It's going to be a problem that the GOP is going to have to address, but I don't think they will.
I don't think they will.
They are not going to. Know,
they're looking at the likes of John Kennedy and Governor Justice in West Virginia,
right.
who was a Democrat and was reelected. And as soon as he was reelected, he changed to the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Republicans, I'm agreeing with you here that the Republicans, I think, are a little too comfortable thinking that these are isolated incidents, just like the Democrats did 8 years ago.
Yes. And I also believe that the Democrats, I keep calling the wrong party name because at this point, if we can't see that they're the same, I don't know what we need glasses.
I've been saying that for years.
But the Republicans who are very stalwart Trump supporters are so committed to that brand because, again, we say this almost every week. That's what it is. It's not even an ideology. It's a brand. They're so committed to the Trump brand and their futures and their fortunes are tied to it that they're not going to defect. They're not going to defect from the message. They're not going to defect from the marketing. They're going to continue to tout Trump's alleged accomplishments like this GDP report that came out that is just as false and misleading to the American worker and to the American people as those unemployment numbers were.
That's right.
I mean, so as long as they have those kinds of fluff pieces to put out to make Trump's brand look good, they're not going to pay any attention to these Republicans who are exercising what little bit of conscience they have left. And especially from someone like Todd Whitman, who you'd have to live in New Jersey to understand the kind of corruption mm-hmm. that was going on with her and her husband and the correction system and what she did to the correction system. Before she was governor, there were programs for rehabilitation in New Jersey prisons. Once she became governor, they were all gone.
Done.
All gone. And a lot of contracts were given to companies that her husband ran. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, these are people who are not, while politically she's respected, there's still this taint of corruption and, you know, typical kind of conservative greed masked as, you know, tough on crime kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's shameful for the GOP that these people are finally exercising their conscience, whatever's left, and the GOP, what's left of it, is going to completely ignore them and continue on with the Trump brand on that train right off the cliff.
Well, before we leave the issue of the presidency, there was an article in the Washington Post today saying that among Democrats, the two front runners by far for the Democratic nomination for president in 2020 are, no surprise, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. That's all a factor of name recognition.
Right.
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 And then you throw a couple of other names in there that people know and they bubble up into, you know, the low teens, the mid teens. Cory Booker, the junior senator from New Jersey, and Kamala Harris, the junior senator from California. They've gone to New Hampshire. They've gone to Iowa. And people are starting to recognize them as national voices for the Democrats. OK,
But there are two other people talking about running for president. One, for me personally, I would actively work against him. And that is Eric Holder.
Yes.
The former attorney general somehow got it into his head that he should be president of the United States. He must have been talking to his mom or something. Because who in the world would want Eric Holder to be the president of the United States is an utter mystery to me. But he said from his $14 million a year job at the law firm of Covington and Burling that he's going to make a decision by the end of the year. Now, the other one is a name that bubbles up every 4 years and nothing ever comes of it. And that's Congressman Tim Ryan of Youngstown, Ohio. So Ryan's a young guy. He's only in his 40s, his early 40s. Good-looking guy, strong labor credentials. He's a moderate Democrat. And that's what most of the Democrats are in that part of Ohio.
Right.
You know, pro-gun, pro-life, pro-labor. They're called laborcrats.
Right.
Well, every few years he talks about challenging Nancy Pelosi for the leadership of the Democratic Party in the House. And he's backed off of that, which is funny because it's only now that there have been credible reports of people wanting to challenge Nancy Pelosi. Well, now Tim Ryan is saying he thinks he wants to be president. What do you make of that?
I mean, so much of politics is just reading the tea leaves, you know, and that's what these guys. I don't expect Ryan's current proclamation to come of anything other than the previous ones have. I'd be surprised if he ended up actually running. But then again, the season we're in politically, anything goes. I agree with you that I would fight against a presidential bid from Eric Holder.
Good
grief. As hard as I would fight against a presidential bid from Cory Booker and Kamala Harris. I just can't. I am not. How do you let the biggest mortgage fraud?
You took the words right out of my mouth. That in and of itself is disqualifying.
I don't understand how Kamala Harris doesn't get challenged on that. If you didn't challenge these people in your state.
Mm-hmm.
Who literally robbed Californians mm-hmm. of their homes through mortgage fraud. If you didn't do that in California, what confidence do I have that you'll do it for anybody else in the rest of the country?
Same with Eric Holder, with this whole nonsense of too big to fail.
That I mean, none of these people held the people who are actually responsible for tanking our economy accountable. Mm-hmm. None of them did.
No.
Not Obama, not Harris, not none of them.
Not at
all. I don't trust any of them.
So I want to close with what I thought was the most fascinating piece of the year. It was published by Axios. Axios was working with Larry Sabato. Larry Sabato is a long, long time professor of political science at the University of Virginia, and probably, along with Charlie Cook, the single most highly respected observer of American politics. He's also the most conservative, with a little c, in that he's the least likely to jump to a conclusion. Like, he really needs to see the numbers, the hard numbers, to decide whether or not he should move a race from the lean category or the strong category to the toss-up category. Larry Sabato was the last one to say that the Democrats are going to sweep the House of Representatives, that it's going to happen quickly. He said that the Democrats are going to pick up an immediate 23 seats. They need 23 seats to win the House. Anything beyond 23 is gravy. And he's predicting now that the Democrats are going to win 34 seats in the House of Representatives. Nancy Pelosi is going to be the Speaker of the House. It will be only the fourth time in the last 60 years that the House of Representatives has changed parties. But we're out of time.
Oh,
I hate to say.
Never
I know,
enough
right?
time.
Never, ever enough time. So I'm going to leave it there. We were joined here in the studio by Jackie Lukman. Jackie is the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. I watched it last week, and it was a load of fun.
Oh, thank you so much.
I really did.
Thank you.
I follow you on Facebook otherwise, but the live stream was great. I enjoyed myself.
We appreciate that.
Well, stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with a lot more.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.